Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
High-speed rail and marine mammals, both in trouble. Hello again, I'm Orin Olney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. California's High-Speed Rail Authority plans to start building its first leg in the Central Valley next year with the ultimate goal of a train from San Diego to San Francisco. But it may be the victim of deficit fever in Washington. Is that a blow to the state's transportation needs or a blessing in disguise for California taxpayers? Also tonight, sea lions and dolphins are dying on the beaches. We'll go to L.A. County's only hospital for sick marine animals. Later on, birthers and the anatomy of a false accusation. First, here's the news. Foreman Olney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. The claim that President Obama was born outside the country might appeal to the right-wing base of the Republican Party, but the repetition of a demonstrable untruth could do more harm to Republicans than Democrats. First, grand jury transcripts unearthed by the L.A. Times might be good news for the city of Bell, which could use some. Some $4.5 million was secretly set aside for pensions by two former officials, the disgraced city administrator Robert Rizzo and his deputy Angela Spasia. Ali Saleh is the new mayor of Bell. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also, congratulations on your election. We haven't talked to you since then.
Thank you very much.
So the grand jury transcripts indicate that those two people secretly set aside a lot of money. Your city budget is $13 million. $4.5 million is a lot.
Definitely. It just shows you the greed and the amount of what they were going after to try to enrich themselves. $4.5 million is a lot of money. And right now the city needs every single dollar that they can get to help stabilize the budget. It just shows you what the previous administration did to enrich themselves. And basically what we're trying to do here is trying to balance the budget and make sure our city stays afloat.
Interesting, too, that a financial consultant at Wells Fargo warned both of them that they might be in trouble. This was even after the L.A. Times revealed what was going on in Bell, and they went ahead anyway.
Exactly. Again, it all comes back to what they were trying to do is milk the city for every dollar that they can. The city is a working class community and a lot of hard workers, and it shows you also that, you know, our property taxes is one of the highest in the county, and yet these guys are trying to do whatever they can to whether it came to milking the city or doing the whole bond situation, all the junk bonds that they did. And yet now they have us stuck with all this debt for generations to come. It's not just now, but it's going to be a long way ahead of us.
What's going to happen with regard to the police force? The city of Maywood is now being policed by Bell. That's enough in itself to cause financial problems. What are you going to do?
Well, we're going to try to do whatever's possible to keep our police department. When we ran during my campaign, my thing was keeping the police department. And I got the top vote getter. It shows you that the people do want to keep their police department. So we're going to try to do whatever is possible to keep our police department. And again, but we have to balance the budget to make sure that we can afford our police department. But I think we will be able to do that.
What about other things that the city provides? Are you going to have to make cuts?
No, at the moment we're not doing any cuts. We're first trying to see how. I mean, we're all new to this. We're all coming in trying to find out all the justifications, where we stand, all the financial aspects. I mean, we had the controller's office give us a number. We had City Hall give us another number, and we have the county give us a number. But now we're trying to get down to business and figure out where we stand. We're going to do an audit that from City Hall, and then we'll figure out where we stand. Until then, we will not make any cuts.
Are you going to be able to bring down the property taxes?
Property taxes are all tied to the bonds. Until the bonds get cleared away, we can't lower the property taxes. But there is a $22 million that is sitting in the non-interest-bearing account that we're trying to see if we can return that back to the bank and see without any penalty. But until then, we're stuck with the property taxes where we're at.
After all that has happened in Bell became an international story, are you being watched pretty closely by the voters?
Definitely. I mean, the last council meeting, we had a full house, and I expect that to be for a long time, and which is great. That shows you that the people are concerned. A lot of residents ask questions, and that's what we want. We want them to come and keep the city hall accountable and ask questions. Again, this is a working-class community, and a lot of people should be interested in government politics, local government politics, and ask these questions of where each dollar is being spent. There's a lot of money that usually before was being spent without any knowledge of where it was being spent. But now our agendas are more detailed, but we want it to be more than what it is now, so people know where every single dollar is being spent.
All right, Ali Saleh, the mayor of the city of Bell, thanks so much for being on our program.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back with Which Way L.A.?
You're listening to Which Way L.A., KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. Warren Olney also hosts To the Point about issues of national concern. Weekdays at noon on KCRW, distributed nationwide by Public Radio International.
Warren Olney back with Which Way L.A. 3 years ago, California voters approved a $9.95 billion bond issue to get started on high-speed rail from San Diego to San Francisco, and construction on the first leg is scheduled to begin next year. The total cost would be much more. The federal government is supposed to put up much of the money, which would then be matched by state funds. But the recent compromise on the federal budget rescinded $400 million for high-speed rail this year and eliminated it altogether for next year. James Moore is professor of engineering at USC, currently on sabbatical at RAND. Professor, good to have you on our program.
Always a pleasure.
You have said that this might be a blessing in disguise for California taxpayers. What are you talking about?
Well, it's a chance to step back, take a good, hard, critical look at where this plan is and what aspects of it are most likely to be feasible. And there aren't many aspects of it that I think are likely to be feasible. So this may give us an opportunity for scrutiny necessary to change our minds.
And change our minds altogether?
Hopefully. The goal would be to make ourselves better off, and this is not a project that will make us better off. It is very expensive, and it won't deliver what has been promised to us. I think any reasonable examination of what has been said and what has happened elsewhere in the world suggests that it won't perform as indicated, and we frankly can't afford failures of this magnitude right now, so we should be more cautious.
What are the promises that have been or will be, you think, not met?
Well, the ridership forecasts are very optimistic. The cost forecasts, both capital and operating, are very optimistic. We've decided that even though we have no experience building these systems, that we're going to build a system that will outperform the best-performing technology anywhere in the world. We're going to be more cost-effective than we have been anywhere in the world or in any other rail system that we have built. We're simply going to set the bar and outperform ourselves in every dimension to hit this mark, and I don't believe that we will. I think prudence suggests that we, in fact, won't.
James Moore at USC, now on sabbatical at RAND. Kurt Pringle is chair of the California High-Speed Rail Authority Board. He's also the former mayor of Anaheim. Kurt Pringle, good to have you on our program.
Glad to be with you, Warren.
What do you say to what we're hearing? Very pessimistic assessment from Jim Moore.
Well, I think the vision of high-speed rail is not shared by everybody in the country, and the opportunity to advance transportation systems in this state, for some of us, have to include other options than just the traditional options. Even though I'm a big supporter of roads and airplanes and other types of transportation services, exclusively focusing on them for the future as the population of the state grows, some people contemplate that we shouldn't prepare for that or plan for that future population growth, that somehow a current economic condition means that all planning should stop. The other side of that is really what the voters initiated in their voting for Prop 1A, the high-speed rail bonds in 2008, and many of us feel is an important addition to the state's transportation network, and that is a high-speed rail system. Many people will portray it differently, but looking at high-speed rail systems around the world, they do perform, and they do pay for their operational service, and that is something that we are proposing in California for the high-speed rail system to pay for its operations, just like they do everywhere else around the world. And at that same level of focus, that's how we are looking to move forward.
Do we have the money in California to come up with the matching funds?
Well, we've requested, or in our overall business plan, to build out the system from Anaheim through Los Angeles, through the Central Valley, across to San Jose, and up to San Francisco, the initial phase one system. We have proposed a large share of those dollars coming from the federal government, $9 billion coming from the state bond commitment that was passed by the voters in 2008, and the balance from private and local sources. As we build this forward, certainly we will see that level of support of the federal government grow, as we are the largest recipient in California of federal high-speed rail money up to this point, and we expect that to continue.
Back to Jim Moore, you have said that the federal government, and I've said in the intro, it seems to be pulling back a bit. Do you disagree with Kurt Pringle that ultimately the federal component will grow?
Well, it's hard to know what this administration is going to do. We're at a point where I think we have to recognize that we can't afford to continue to deficit spend our way forward as a nation. 1929, Herbert Hoover had it wrong, and Franklin Roosevelt had it right, and priming the pump made a lot of sense. But that strategy is not an infinite resource. You can't deficit spend forever. You have to eventually service that debt. And if you can't service the debt, then you can't borrow anymore, and you can't deficit spend. And then you have a worldwide recession that's much harder to get out of. And so, yes, I think things will change. I don't think that federal practices in the past few years have been sustainable. I think that we have to take steps to pull back on the national debt, and that's going to mean eliminating first the most discretionary expenditures. And the most discretionary expenditures are the ones that make the least economic sense. And unfortunately, California's high-speed rail plan qualifies.
Kurt Pringle, you're a Republican. Do you disagree with the deficit-cutting, spending-cutting Republicans in Washington?
Well, I actually think it's an interesting discussion on how this point is framed. You know, if you look back at the stimulus funds of over $700 billion that were focused on stimulating the economy, people can debate on the dollars that were spent there and how they were used. And in most cases, they were spent on programmatic purposes. Only 60-some billion dollars was dedicated to infrastructure investment, of which the $8 billion that came to high-speed rail came from that pot. So you can, for another show, Warren, you can argue over the expenditure of those $700 billion. Yet the $60 billion of infrastructure investment and then the $8 billion focused on high-speed rail investment in the country is really where this discussion is. So it's not adding trillions of dollars to the deficit or how important it is to cut back the expenditure of the federal government. That's not what this discussion is, even though high-speed rail gets some of that focus because it's something new. It's planning for the future. But no one is in the same breath arguing to eliminate highway funds or other infrastructure construction. And that is essential for many of us when you think about planning your country's future and your state's future. It's awfully hard at this point in time to say we should not plan to build the infrastructure necessary to support it.
Jim Moore, why do you call what Mr. Pringle describes as planning for future growth, which is inevitable in California, discretionary? Isn't it necessary to plan for the future and be ready to meet transportation needs?
Well, it's certainly necessary to plan. There's no question about that. Fossil fuels are a limited resource. We do have to manage what resources we have. No, we worry about a lot of the indirect effects of the automobile, and we should. Those costs are real. Unfortunately, the power for high-speed rail has to come from somewhere, and in most cases, it's going to come from fuel. So some of the basic premises about how sustainable and how important it is to plan for a sustainable alternative by turning to this mode, I think really are wrong-headed and not accurate. We do have to plan, absolutely. We have to make sure that we've got enough road space. We've got to make sure that we've got a way to manage the road system. We've got to find a way to Make sure that people, when they decide to travel in a congested facility, bear the full cost of that decision so they don't travel unless the trip is valuable enough to them to account for the costs they're inflicting system-wide. And these are all standard economic perspectives. There's a lot of planning we have to do to make sure that we have a way forward and that our society can develop and that our economy can develop and people have opportunities. But if you step back and ask the fundamental question, does high-speed rail do this? The answer, unfortunately, is no. And the discussion doesn't begin after the assumption we need high-speed rail because we need to plan. Okay, so what do we do now? The question is, does high-speed rail actually move us in this direction? I mean, I love technology. I would love it if high-speed rail was a great way forward because I think it would be neat to ride on a high-speed train. But if I step back and look at the likely cost and the likely benefits and what we would have to accomplish to be able to achieve any real benefits, it just makes no economic sense to me at all. This is not a complex calculation.
Kurt Pringle, what about right now? You know, there's many billions of dollars that's not coming from the federal government that was anticipated. Can you keep going? Can you start building the first leg out in the valley without that federal money?
Well, yes, we certainly can, start focusing on initiating the construction of that initial construction segment in the Central Valley and then connecting it to a population center in the south or in the north. And what a lot of people miss is the fact that if you don't build a transportation system like high-speed rail, what are the alternatives? And if you look at the ridership and the capacity that's being that high-speed rail would be able to support, you need to build the equivalent of 3,000 additional freeway lane miles in the state. That's not free. That doesn't come without a cost of land impacts, of monetary impacts. So the interesting trade-off is if you don't build high-speed rail, we'll just continue to do what we're doing. But if we continue to do what we're doing, that means someone's going to pay for it. And, part of the focus is how do you ensure that there's an alternative to the existing system that is, of competitive value, that is not reliant upon, gasoline and gasoline prices that are $4, $5, $6 a gallon.
Jim Moore, you said at the outset that the plan for the California high-speed rail requires it to outperform in many ways high-speed rail systems that already exist in other places. What did you mean by that?
Well, I meant several things. We would have to achieve higher speeds than any other operating system that exists anywhere in the world. We would have to evade subsidies that currently do flow to the European systems. I mean, when the head of Amtrak goes to Washington to plead for funds for his system, he points to Europe and says, look, they subsidize their high-speed rail system, so you folks have to subsidize me. Whether we call those operating subsidies or another kind of subsidy just doesn't really matter to me. It's all one bottom line, ultimately. So we would have to go faster. We'd have to move more people more quickly. We'd have to outperform systems that have been in place for many years. And we'd have to do so very cheaply. And we, as a rule, don't build anything very cheaply in this country.
Let me interrupt. Go back to Kurt Pringle. Is your vision unrealistic?
We don't think so. I mean, and it's interesting that, Professor Moore's comment is it would have to go faster. It would have to carry more people. All our projections and our estimates in building the system are based upon the current technology. We believe the current technology is going to improve in the next 20 years. So when we plan for the environmental clearance of the system, we're planning for speeds up to 220 miles an hour. Our environmental planning requirements say that we have to demonstrate what that impact would be. So we have to plan for a system so that, in fact, when the system is completed within the next decade or so in a certain segment, it's not obsolete on the first day. So, yes, we are planning for the future as to where the technology will evolve, but trains would be able to operate today under all the existing technologies that are available. It isn't required to have a unique or different or expanded or growing technology before the system in California would work.
Okay. The debate goes on. It will go on for a long time. We'll see what the federal government comes up with and whether the state can play its role. Kurt Pringle, chair of the California High-Speed Rail Authority Board, thanks to you. Jim Moore at USC and now at RAND, thank you as well.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
I'll be right back with Which Way LA.
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayla. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
Warman Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on Which Way LA. There's been a considerable number of dolphins and sea lions dead or dying on Southern California beaches of late, but they're just the onshore evidence of a deadly epidemic that's come up the food chain. What you're hearing are the voices of recovering animals at the Marine Mammal Care Center at Fort MacArthur in San Pedro. It's L.A. County's only hospital for sick, injured, and orphaned marine animals. KCRW's Katie Cooper visited recently and talked with David Bard, the director of operations.
The patients that you're looking at in this enclosure are California sea lions who are coming in with symptoms consistent with domoic acid toxicity. This is a condition that stems from a naturally occurring algal bloom out in the ocean. The diatom in question is consumed by filter feeders like sardines and anchovies, and as it works its way up the food chain, it acts as a neurotoxin on these animals. So they come in sometimes in a comatose state, sometimes disoriented, suffering seizures, ataxic, and they're usually well-fed because they've been eating the fish in the wild, but unable to care for themselves and very unaware of their surroundings because of their condition.
And how long have these animals been here?
These have been here between a few days and a couple of weeks. We do put them on anticonvulsants to control the seizures, and then we try to get some subcutaneous fluids into them so that we can start flushing the toxin out of their system.
And where did these animals, where were they found?
All of the animals in our care come from Los Angeles County beaches. Members of the public will often see them on the beach. There are several rescue agencies in Los Angeles County who are able to transport the animals to us when they need to be brought in. It is important to point out and to remember that these animals often use the beach as haul-out space, and it doesn't always mean that they need help if they're sighted on the beaches. It can also be dangerous to approach them since they are wild animals, and they are actually protected under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. So it's a good idea to keep your distance. And if you are concerned about a particular animal on the beach, contact the lifeguard or the designated rescue agencies.
And I understand that there are animals who are on the rebound that you've been taking care of.
Yeah, actually, if you look in the next enclosure over, this is our large pool, Pen 6, and with the exception of the large male that's in here, all the adult females that you see are cases that came in as DA suspect cases. So these are the ones who have... are on the road to recuperation, have gotten aware of their surroundings, they're feeding on their own now, and hopefully we'll be able to pick out some release candidates before too long.
That was David Barr at the Marine Mammal Care Center at Fort MacArthur talking to KCRW's Katie Cooper. David Caron is professor of biological sciences at USC. Professor, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
I understand this domoic acid problem happens quite often, but that this is worse than usual.
It is worse than usual. You know, we've had for the last 8 years or so, we've been able to document domoic acid in the plankton off our coast more years than not, but we've had a few very bad years, and this is one of them, unfortunately.
Does this have anything to do with agricultural runoff or urban runoff?
Well, it's a really good question, and that is really an area of very active research. You know, we do know that there are natural sources of nutrients that are supplied from the ocean that promote phytoplankton blooms. That's a good thing, but every now and then we get one of these nasty or toxic ones. And the question is, are our influences, human influences on the coastline, adding nutrients that are somehow stimulating or promoting the growth of these harmful algae? And the basic answer is, in this particular situation, we don't know. There certainly are cases around the country where coastal eutrophication because of human activity on the coastline has contributed to harmful algal blooms, but it's more difficult to tell in our coastline.
I understand that the millions of sardines that died in King Harbor recently had domoic acid poisoning. Do you suppose they were part of what the animals we just heard might have been eating?
No, I think those particular fish were not the cause. The concentrations of domoic acid in those fish were not that high, and it's highly unlikely that they would have affected the marine life adversely. There were lots of seabirds, I mean hundreds of seabirds, that were feeding on those dead fish in King Harbor, and I think we would have seen the effect much more immediate than we have in this particular case. That was on March 8th, so the 8th and 9th they were kind of feeding on the fish, and we're a good, you know, more than a month later, and we're seeing more mammals, I think, than birds at this point.
We heard David Bard talking about seizures. What about the symptoms that sea lions and dolphins show when they're out in the ocean? There were reports of dolphins swimming among surfers.
Yes, they do get completely disoriented, and I've literally had people call me from their sailboats and say, you know, there's a sea lion in the water here acting very strangely, literally they are disoriented. They don't know what they're doing in many cases. So and that's the reason that David warns people to keep their distance, because they are unpredictable.
What about birds?
Seabirds as well, if they're feeding on animals that are liable to collect domoic acid in them. So filter feeding fish like anchovies and sardines. Pelicans is often one of the species that we see affected by domoic acid. But also filter feeding bivalves, so clams and mussels, anything feeding on those, or even, unfortunately, at the beach line, if the toxic bloom is up on the beach, little sand crabs can pick it up in them, and birds feeding on them can have a problem with domoic acid poisoning as well.
Very quickly, if you can, are humans affected by domoic acid?
Absolutely. If it gets into our food chain, just as with the sea lions and other animals, it will cause a variety of neurological symptoms. Usually in humans, domoic acid poisoning is referred to as amnesic shellfish poisoning, because it can result in loss of short-term memory, but it can be more severe. There are a few human deaths that have been attributed to domoic acid in the past.
This should be over quickly.
It should be. These things are usually a few weeks to maybe a month in duration. They have been becoming more regular and in frequency, and unfortunately more severe in recent years. So we're waiting to see what happens with this one.
Well, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
David Caron, professor of biological sciences at USC. You can join the conversation on our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, the anatomy of a false accusation on Which Way LA. Warren Olney back with Which Way LA. Barack Obama's birth certificate says he was born in Hawaii on August 4th, 1961. Local newspapers carried announcements at the time. Recent investigations by mainstream media have confirmed that he meets the constitutional requirement that the president must be a natural-born citizen. Today, CNN aired this conclusion from Dr. Shlaim Fukino, a Republican and former director of Hawaii's Department of Public Health. She described the so-called long-form birth certificate stored in a vault in Honolulu.
It was absolutely authentic. He was absolutely born here in the state of Hawaii.
Nevertheless, polls show a significant percentage of Americans still believes that Obama was born someplace else. Ben Smith co-authored a story in Politico titled Birtherism, Where It All Began. Ben Smith, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
Where did it all begin?
It actually all began in the kind of mists of the spring of 2008, when Hillary Clinton's most kind of intense supporters on the internet, who had been previously peddling a rumor that Barack Obama was a Muslim, started instead peddling a rumor that he was not born in the United States. And that was before he was the nominee, before Republicans really got around to hating him. It was during that kind of real slog between Clinton and Obama. And then it kind of petered out through the rest of 2008. It was not the sort of current smear against Barack Obama during that campaign. It really kind of took wing just after he was elected.
Didn't it actually begin in 2004 when a local politician in Illinois brought it up?
That was sort of the beginnings of the smear campaign against him, but that really focused on the notion that he was a Muslim. And that guy, Andy Martin, who has sort of been the lead peddler of smear campaigns against Obama and has another sideline in kind of anti-Semitic court filings, he actually thinks Obama was born in the United States. So this was sort of a strange stepchild of the rumor that he was a Muslim.
In your story, you called this a theory in search of facts.
Yeah, I mean, there's this underlying sense that Barack Obama, who has a funny name, who was raised abroad, has a life story that some people find difficult to identify with. That he's foreign in some sense, and also who's liberal, right? So and for conservatives, I mean, so that he's other, that he's foreign, the first black president, and then this inchoate sense that he's foreign has been seizing on these just sort of provably false theories about him to try to prove that he's in fact foreign.
So it just sort of makes him the other.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like that's kind of the underlying sentiment behind behind an attempt to prove that he is in fact a literal foreigner.
To what extent have the Republicans been repeating it? We know, of course, about Donald Trump.
Well, the Republican Party leadership had been trying pretty hard to stamp this out. I mean, people like Tim Pawlenty, like Mitt Romney, the sort of likely presidential nominees, have said very flatly that that Obama was born in the United States. McCain certainly said it. But they haven't conducted the kind of purge that you saw, for instance, Democrats do with anybody who suggested that George Bush was behind 9/11. Like, that would really get you drummed out of the party. And now Donald Trump has come onto the scene and is sort of actively pushing it. A lot of state legislators around the country have also, there's a dozen or so bills in state legislatures sort of related to this, demanding birth certificates of presidential candidates. So it's sort of an acceptable position for Republicans, and Donald Trump has made it into a very high-profile one.
Acceptable to some but not others. The governor of Arizona just vetoed a bill.
Well, a lot of Republican leaders see it as, a real political danger because it's false and to a lot of people seems totally loony. And you don't want to be the party of lunatics. And further, I think, and perhaps more important, it's really not what people care about. Even people who are telling pollsters maybe, that they think Obama was born somewhere else or that this is not like the top shelf, top of mind issue for most Republican voters. It's, it's the economy, like for everybody else.
So who then is this directed at?
It's for Donald Trump, I think it's directed in some part at getting him on television. In some part, it is a token for I'm going to stand up to President Obama, who you hate, and I'm going to call him names, and I'm going to fight him tooth and nail, where these other candidates are being too polite. But I think it is reflecting this real sense from Republican voters that they want somebody who's really going to stand up and fight Obama, and I think that's kind of part of what Trump is trying to capitalize on.
Interesting. Michelle Obama, the congresswoman from Minnesota, has been pardon me.
Michelle Bachmann,
I beg your pardon. has been very much a part of those who say they want to stand up and not necessarily be polite, but she doesn't go for this.
She sort of wandered into it. I mean, it's obviously something, it's being chattered about. And honestly, it's confusing. If you don't spend half an hour reading about it, which is kind of a lot to spend reading, you can easily go down some garden path and think it's real. There's lots of smoke in the air about it. But I think she sort of, was in an interview floated the notion that she maybe thought there was something here and then thought about it, thought better of it, and very abruptly walked it back.
I hope I never make that mistake again and call Michelle
Obama. Everybody's going to be offended.
I hope not. Ben Smith, again, is a senior political writer for Politico. Gary Langer is president of Langer Research Association. He's also a pollster for ABC News. And, Gary, it's good to have you back on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
What about this New York Times poll? It says 45% of Republicans think that the president was born overseas. Do your polls bear that out?
Well, a couple of things. One, we have to be really careful in evaluating this sort of research data. You introduced this segment by saying, a quarter of Americans overall still believe that Barack Obama was born in a foreign country. I think these measurements are not truly reflecting belief in the traditional sense of the phrase, an expression of a factual reality. Polls do not do a very good job at measuring factual belief. They do a good job at measuring opinions. And in response to these questions exactly like this one, many people are expressing their opinion rather than an assertion of factual reality. People who don't like you are going to take the opportunity to send a message by saying negative things about you. And that's happening with a large number of the people who are saying that they, quote-unquote, believe that Barack Obama was born overseas. They're simply taking the advantage of an opportunity to express antipathy toward him.
Having described Michelle Bachmann by the wrong name, I have to take issue with you. I did not say 25% of the people believe that he was born someplace else. I said significant percentages of Americans still believe he was born someplace else. What is the percentage?
Well, it depends what you mean by the word believe. In our survey, we asked people, not in a prompted way, if they thought he was born in another country, but simply open-ended, as far as you know, where was Barack Obama born? 14% of Americans in our survey said they thought he was born in another country. For those who didn't know, we gave them the option, do you think he was born in the United States or in another country? You get a net of maybe 20% of Americans saying he was born in another country. But then we ask a follow-up question, Warren. Do you think there's been any hard evidence of that, or is it your suspicion only? A majority of those who said they thought he was born in another country also said it was their suspicion only, making this far less than an assertion of factual information and rather an expression of antipathy.
So the New York Times, then, may be exaggerating the situation.
Well, I think all of the news media in their reporting of this information have probably been committing some exaggeration. By suggesting that this is a firm, if you will, factual belief of very substantial numbers of the American population. We just have to understand how people answer these sorts of questions. We may be asking about the trees, and they may be telling us about the forest. If you ask people if they want to sign on to a pejorative statement about Barack Obama, then those who strongly disapprove of him may well disproportionately take the opportunity to do so. Again, not as an expression of factual belief, but simply as a way to let us know that they don't like the guy.
Gary Langer with Langer Research and ABC News. Back to Ben Smith with Politico. So there's good reason for Republican leaders to kind of tiptoe around this.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think Gary is absolutely right that it's very easy to overstate. You know, the intensity with which huge numbers of Republicans say this, and I think, you know, that Times poll and the way it was presented did suggest there was some kind of mass insanity going on among Republicans, which I think, yeah, is a very easy thing to overstate. But I think the main reason Republican leaders, you know, are tiptoeing around it is because, you know, they're heading into an election that's going to be decided by people in the middle, swing voters, who, you know, not only are they not, I mean, to whom this is like bizarre talk radio / internet fever swamp lunacy, you know, of the same kind that like 9/11 beliefs that Bush was behind 9/11 or any number of other kind of wild conspiracy theories. And, you know, they just aren't going to, I think, you know, we'll judge somebody who's peddling it harshly.
Gary Langer, how long do you think or based on the comparisons we've heard and the fact that we've seen this happen before, how long do you think it might take for this to either gain some further traction, or do you think that the peak has pretty much been hit?
Yeah, well, I imagine it. You know, the numbers have been stable for the past year and more in terms of the expressed belief, not affirmed, but expressed belief that Barack Obama was born in a different country. People who don't like him will say that. At the same time, I think Ben is quite right that at a time of $4 gasoline, nearly 9% unemployment, and an increasingly unpopular war in Afghanistan, this is very much of a sideshow in terms of the factors that are influencing public attitudes towards politics and certainly toward Barack Obama's prospects at re-election.
So you think people really are focused on those issues, and again, to use your term, this is a sideshow?
Without question, yeah.
Mark Fenster is a professor of law at the University of Florida and author of Conspiracy Theories, Secrecy and Power in American Culture. Thank you for being on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Do you think that this is just a sideshow, or is it something that reminds you of other conspiracy theories that have been circulated in the United States?
Well, the clear analogy, as the other guests have noted, is with the 9/11 conspiracy theory stuff, much of which reached its peak right around the time that President Bush became the least popular during his presidency. So I think the point that Gary made, that we could read this as a form of, as a sort of inchoate antipathy towards the president, seems right in a lot of ways. Whether it's a sideshow or not, I mean, in some ways, it is, of course, a quite marginal issue, except for those who are absolutely sold on it. And it's likely to get crowded out. But for those people who are deep believers in it. It's much more than a sideshow.
When you say that it's a marginal, why do you think it is that some Republican leaders, not just Mr. Trump, but others have, while not coming out all in favor of it, have ducked the question in a lot of ways, have said, I'll take the president at his word or something of that kind? What does that have to do with trying to appeal to that base that you say is never going to give this up?
Well, I think that's right. And I should distinguish between the base that would see this as being a particularly important issue, which is probably a small number within the Republican Party, and those people who would attach this as part of a general feeling that the president is illegitimate in some way and harbors some greater harm to the nation. So I think the issue then is somewhat to the core group, but also more generally to those who are deeply opposed to the president. The issue for a presidential candidate who, unlike Mr. Pawlenty and Mr. Romney, are more likely to appeal to swing voters, it's for those folks who want to put out a dog whistle or at least play footsie with the folks on the far end of the party who are going to show up for caucuses and who are going to show up at primaries.
So, Ben Smith, with the Politico, this could then have some impact in particularly the early states in Iowa, in New Hampshire.
You know, I mean, I think it's already had an impact in the sense that it's helped get Trump on the radar, partly because because people like us are sort of fascinated by it and talk about it a lot and are kind of interested in the sociological phenomenon of it. It's just gotten him a ton of attention. But I think it's, there's a space for it, but it's a space that kind of limits itself. I mean, it's there are folks at every town hall, there's going to be a couple of people who really want to talk about it, and they will love you if you indulge them. But you're going to alienate the majority, even, I would think, in a Republican primary, even in the most conservative states.
Gary Langer, what about Trump and his showing in the polls?
Well, a lot of that at this point is about celebrity. It's no surprise, I think, that the figures who are most supported in any of the horse race surveys now about the potential Republican candidates are those who are best known, who ran previously or who have television programs. At this stage in the race, a lot of this is about name recognition. It does tell us that there hasn't been a lot of differentiation made among the potential candidates. This field is coalescing very slowly. By this time 4 years ago, everyone was in, had announced their candidacy, and therefore were enabling voters to start making some informed choices. Now it's coming together much later. People don't really know who the choice of candidates is. Therefore, Republicans in our survey are far less inclined than they were 4 years ago to say they're satisfied with the choices available to them. You know, let's remember that if Donald Trump gets 15% in a poll or in our unprompted poll, we didn't read the names, you just asked people who they support, he got 8%. That means 80 and 90% of Republicans are picking someone else, or most often at this stage, no one.
Mark Fenster, back to you at the University of Florida, author of Conspiracy Theories, Secrecy and Power in American Culture. Tell us a little bit about the dynamics of conspiracy theories and how this one either sounds like they all do or sounds somewhat different.
Well, the analogy question is an interesting one because in some ways this reminds me of the Vince Foster suicide story that plagued is too strong a word, but that struck during President Clinton's first term and was one of those stories that did not reach probably the degree of public consciousness that the birth certificate story has reached, but was very important to a core group of folks on the right who were convinced that the Clintons were somehow illegitimate. And that same sort of cycle of a kind of weird set of facts, a somewhat marginal group of folks who were pushing it, some allegations that didn't seem to be completely unprovable in any sort of direct way, seemed to take on a life of its own and spun out into other sorts of conspiracies that or conspiracy theories that I wouldn't say plagued again President Clinton, but ran a sort of noise campaign under President Clinton's first term.
Vince Foster, a suicide, there was accusations of murder in that situation. Have there been these sort of spin-offs in the case of the president and his birthplace?
Not that I know of, other than the general sense that he is bringing on some form of socialist autocracy. So the healthcare legislation itself augurs some greater conspiracy that is likely to be at work. But that's not tied to any particular factual thing in the way that the birth certificate issue is.
Mark Fenster at the University of Florida Law School. Wayne Bennett is an attorney in Philadelphia. He publishes a blog at thefieldnegro.com. Wayne Bennett, it's good to have you back on our show.
Good to be here, Warren. How are you?
Good. What's your take on all this?
Well, I think it's interesting. I was listening, I think it was to Ben, and he mentioned that this being a difficult life story, and that kind of fits into an overall narrative, doesn't it? I mean, if we were talking about a father who was born in Poland or Ireland, I think we'd be talking about a classic American story, if you will. I mean, he has such a fascinating background, he meaning Barack Obama. But I think this story, and speaking from people of color's view, I think from that standpoint about this story, I think most African Americans are really upset about this story because of the they see it as, you know, this is the first African American president. Why wasn't these questions raised about the 43 white male presidents we had before? He was elected, unlike George Bush. You can argue whether he was elected by the Supreme Court or what have you, but there was questions of legitimacy with his election. With Barack Obama, he was elected by majority. So a lot of African Americans view this as more of a racial issue. He's this other exotic with a funny name. He's black. But I'm going to make some news on your show. As an African American man, I don't think it's all Tea Party members are racist. I don't think that this is purely racial. I think it's a lot of it is ideological. I think a lot of it is political. And I think in the case of Donald Trump, obviously he's doing it for political reasons to raise his profile in the Republican Party. So do I think there's some of that going on, some of that meaning racism towards this particular president? Yes. But I don't think, like a lot of others in my community, that it's the overriding issue. It's the majority of Tea Party people are all racist and they just don't want a black man in the White House.
Is this something then, given what Gary Langer said, particularly about how there's really a rather small number of Americans who feel very certain about this, that we really just ought to look away from?
I don't think we can, though, really, because when you're talking about a major political party with and I understand that I heard the pollster mentioning, I mean, 15-20% of people within the Republican Party. I'm not sure of the numbers, but I think it is an issue. I think, you know, it's so just ludicrous, the whole idea that he wasn't born in this country, and that to have even 5, 10, 15% of people believing that, for whatever reason, I think it says a lot about us as Americans, doesn't it? I mean, it's really kind of sad. I mean, it's all a part of the snookerization of American culture, if you will. I mean, we're just so easily swayed by our beliefs and just really far out ideas and conspiracies.
What do you think the president ought to do about it?
I think he should do nothing about it. I think, from a pure political standpoint, if I was advising him, I would say let it keep it going. I mean, I'm sure there are those of us on the fringes and people who are his supporters or people of color who are upset because they view this all as some kind of, you know, racial backlash and, you know, white people coming down on our president. But if I were Barack Obama, I would not even I would welcome this because, as I think, I'm not sure if it was Ben mentioned, I mean, if you win these elections with the middle, and people who are in the middle are not going to believe this stuff, and it kind of marginalizes people in the Republican Party or those who want to run on the Republican ticket come November. So I think if I were Barack Obama, by all means, keep it going because, you know, gas, $4 a gallon, unemployment 9%, war raging in Afghanistan. I mean, this is great for him to take people's minds off of those real issues.
David Winston is a Republican pollster and strategist, columnist for Roll Call, election analyst with CBS News, director of planning under the former House Speaker Newt Gingrich. David Winston, good to have you back on our program.
Thanks for having me.
What should Republicans do about this?
Well, I think you've begun to see Republicans finally just very harshly address this issue. I mean, clearly, he was born in this country, right? And in fact, the woman that you were quoting before, who's the former health director of the Hawaii Department of Health, was a Republican, right? And she said she's seen the birth certificate. And I think it's time to, as I think Gary was sort of pointing out, look, what Americans are concerned about is the economy, jobs, gas prices. And one of the complaints they had about the president in terms of the last cycle was the fact that he wasn't focused on the issues they thought was important. And I will tell you, if the country begins to feel that Republicans are focusing on this issue, not only is it an issue that they don't see as central, but it's also it's an issue that's just seen as incredibly extreme. I mean, when you look at the facts, there is nothing that supports the standing. And I say, and I have to say that in terms of Donald Trump, it reflects poorly on him that he has not taken what I would consider to be the due diligence to look at an issue of this level of controversy.
So you kind of agree then with what we heard from Wayne Bennett that if there's a distraction, it might be good for President Obama.
Yeah, no, and I'm going to say it a little bit more harshly than he would for obvious reasons. But I think, look, any day that you can have a conversation not about gas prices and jobs in the economy, given where they're at, and instead focusing on something that seems just way off base, that's a better day for the president. And I would suggest that those individuals who are probably pursuing this, if they thought through it, they would realize they were probably helping the president more than hurting him.
Let me go back to Ben Smith, the senior political writer for Politico. When you wrote your article, Birthism, Where It All Began, you found that when the president did release his birth certificate, it had a certain result. What was it?
Yeah, that's when people really started paying attention to this theory and imagining there was something there and looking for flaws in the document, creating forged documents. That actually was sort of when the theory really took off, when he released the document. And there is an element of this that isn't, I mean, for its tiny hardcore believers, is not going to be debunked because they believe it as an article of faith.
Mark Fenster, back with you, conspiracy theories, secrecy and power in American culture. Is there any way for the president to deal with that, or are both Wayne Bennett and David Winston right that what he ought to do is absolutely nothing?
Well, there is pretty much nothing that he can do. The hardcore conspiracy theory believer, as Ben noted, is someone who is so focused on the minutiae of details that any effort to debunk will merely constitute another set of reasons and further evidence of the existence of the conspiracy. So even if he wanted to, I don't think that there's any way for him to address this. Even if he decided to present whatever document, whatever long form or whatever, the specific document that the birther folks claim he has not yet presented, it would not be accepted as true.
I want to thank you all for being with us. Wayne Bennett again, an attorney in Philadelphia, blogging at thefieldnegro.com. Mark Fenster at the University of Florida, his book, Conspiracy Theories, Secrecy and Power in American Culture. David Winston, Republican pollster and strategist, a columnist for Roll Call, election analyst for CBS, formerly with the former House Speaker Newt Gingrich. Gary Langer, president of Langer Research and a pollster for ABC News. Ben Smith, senior political writer for Politico.com. Thank you all very much for being on our program. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Which Way LA was produced tonight by Sonia Geis, Gary Scott, and Karen Radziner. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page at kcrw.com/whichwayla. And you can join the conversation on Which Way LA's Facebook page. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.